Hello and welcome back to Searching Inward, a podcast brought to you by Restore Small Groups here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm George, joined with Seth and Anna, and a special guest with us today that we're excited for you to hear from. And someone has just been introduced to Restore through Seth, a good friend of Seth, Jason Adam Miller. And Jason is the author of the book, When the World Breaks, a book that reexamines the Beatitudes and the eight paradoxes found in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and points to a whole new way to find hope in midst of suffering. He's a pastor at South Bend City Church, an eclectic church community known for its thoughtful teaching, inclusive vision, and commitment to its city context. So we are so grateful to have Jay with us, and you're going to get to hear from him today. And all of us, Anna and Scott and a couple of our friends, got to go through Jay's book and took 10 weeks, read through each chapter, and he has something on YouTube where you can follow along, and he kind of guides us throughout the book. And it was just amazing, a wonderful journey of just how to find hope when there's suffering and struggle. So Jay, welcome. So glad that you agreed to this. And he is someone I think speaks such a helpful voice in bringing mental health and well-being and faith together in such a meaningful way. Because some of us, we come from experiences with our faith where perhaps our faith wasn't so helpful. And in a lot of ways, maybe it even got in the way of a more helpful journey on our journey of well-being. So Jay, say hello, and can you just introduce yourself? How would you introduce yourself?
First of all, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me. Seth is a long time, like best friend of mine. But you two, Anna and George, you've become friends as well. And so I'm thrilled to join you all. And getting to know Restore through Seth's work with you all has been really inspiring to me. So I'm thrilled. To introduce myself further, I don't know what to say. I really like going to concerts, and I really like food. And
what's the last concert you went to?
I love what y'all are up to. Great question. The last one I remember was at Half Alive in LA at the Wiltern. But that was a little while ago, but it was excellent. Yeah.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about, obviously you're a pastor, but you're such a meaningful voice to so many of us. I'm a pastor, but I also, you know, I have a heart just, I remember when I was a younger pastor, my counselor friends would tell us they wouldn't send people who were struggling with an addiction or struggling in something, they wouldn't send us to us pastors. They were fearful. And that kind of broke my heart, because I've always felt like the church should be the safest place. But places of faith haven't always been that safest place for people to go when they're struggling in some way. But what kind of opened your heart to care about this and bringing kind of faith and, you know, a mental health journey as companions together?
Yeah, I think there's two sort of dovetailed things here. One is my own story. When I was coming out of high school, I sort of flooded with this whole Pandora's box of traumatic childhood memories that I had not been aware of. And that sent me on like a 4-year spiral into deepening depression that became acute enough that I chose to hospitalize myself in my early 20s for about 10 days. Anyway, that disabused me of like any illusions about whether like, you know, our stories, our wounds, our traumas, whether those are like things that you can keep at bay or whether you have to like face and work with them. And during that time, I mean, as is the case now, like I was really committed to my faith, and I was trying to figure out how like faith had anything to do with this. You know, I have these journals where I would like pray about it and, you know, like rifle through scripture, trying to find all these promises about healing, and it didn't work I mean, I'm not saying it was bad to have those scriptures, but they weren't the kind of like shortcut to the healing that I needed. And at the same time, I wanted to bring my faith with me. And so that was a real like working out period of time, leading up to and during the hospitalization and afterwards. Like on the one hand, I have these faith commitments and this story that I still trust, but I don't know what to make of it or think about it differently now. And on the other hand, I have this experience. And then the other is a really, really close person in my life battled a very acute addiction and was in the throes of that for more than a decade. From time to time, I was the one sort of on the front lines with that person when it was at its worst and most destructive in their life. And then also, you know, that destruction sort of folding out into other lives around that person. I've also then had the privilege of being on the front row seat for that person's recovery. and the transformation in their life and the healing in their life that hasn't just been healing for them, but healing for me and for others. And so those two experiences side by side make it pretty hard to not ask hard questions about how's all this fit together? You know, like, because part of it for me is like, if my faith doesn't have anything actually meaningful to say to these experiences I've just described, I should probably get rid of it, because I don't know what would be the point. You know, if you can't sort of run it through the stress test of these real human experiences, it probably doesn't have a lot to offer, you know?
Jay, I'm gonna quote you. On your Instagram, you did a video just kind of on mental health and faith. And you said this: if faith is anything, it ought to be the thing that reminds us we are complex, a way of honoring the depth and complexity of our humanity, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And I guess when faith works until it doesn't at a particular time in our life, we encounter some kind of experience and the faith we were given, you know, sometimes it doesn't work. And you could do one of two things. You could entirely chuck faith, or you can open up to maybe a new way of understanding your faith that could be more helpful, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the play. And I don't mean this in some sort of like, I'm not really big on like defending my faith in the sense of like trying to prove or argue for others. But I'll just say for me, from my experience, for probably a bunch of reasons, I didn't want to give up on it. So I kind of doubled down and trying to figure out if there was a version of it that would be helpful in healing. And my own disposition, my own approach to that is like, I'm not really just looking for like spinning it in any direction that works for me. To me, that kind of defies some sense of like transcendent truth. It was more like burrowing deeper into its resources, going deeper into its tradition, and wondering if these experiences could, you know, push me further into it beyond the version I'd been given. Because of course, any tradition, whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist or whatever, has had thousands of years to sort of express itself and pivot and adapt. And maybe the version you got isn't the only version, and maybe the version you got isn't even the most faithful version. And so to me, the invitation on all of that was to go further in and to find out that, in fact, there were readings of Christian faith that became like deeply healing for me, but they weren't entirely the ones I had inherited.
Yeah. And Jay, I mean, you're such a generous voice. Like, I love that you give others freedom to navigate their faith and their journey. But here's a question I have for you. In what ways were you surprised to discover, as you went deeper, that your faith mattered more? How did you experience that?
Yeah, you know, this was kind of right into the center part of the story for me. When I went to the hospital in my early 20s, that was really healing. I grieved a lot. I basically, more than anything else, those 10 days were when I stopped trying to run from it. And I kind of let this grief fully consume me. And that's what, like for 3 days, I just sobbed, just like straight. And that began sort of to turn the tide from a deepening depression to some clouds parting. But I came out of the hospital and there was two things I was then grappling with. One was like, I was really mad at God, because I was like, man, I'm happy that I'm better now, but now I'm pretty pissed. Like, why did it have to hurt that bad, you know? And where the hell were you? I mean, those were really the sentiments that I had. And it was kind of in the midst of that that I, you know, Christians have different ways of talking about Jesus and the cross. And I think there are really problematic ways of rendering that whole moment theologically, like what happened there. And I think there are really healing ways of doing that. And I kind of stumbled into what I think is a healing and like very traditional way of reading the cross, but one I'd not heard about before. There's a prayer in the Bible, in the Psalms, that really accuses God of being fickle and absent or even violent toward us. And like, I really latched onto that prayer, because I was still trying to make it faith. I was still like trying to do the Bible thing. So like, even in my anger against God, I was kind of channeling it through my relationship with the Bible. And this particular prayer, I latched onto it, and it was my protest for a number of weeks before I realized then that it's actually the same psalm that Jesus prays on the cross when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And for me, that was a really radical turning point where the cross became an experience of divine solidarity with our suffering, rather than like an indictment of our humanity or a, you know, we are so horrible that like God had to kill Jesus. Like I think those are really problematic theologies, but instead it was, we are so loved that God has like in a body experienced divine abandonment. You know, it's kind of a paradox. And so for me, you know, and I think even if you leave the theology behind and you just move to psychology, empathy and solidarity are healing experiences, right? And for me, it was profound to not just have people walking with me, but through that encounter to really feel a sense of God being sort of fully with me in those things. So that's sort of the long version of where my relationship to Christian tradition pivoted and became really powerful.
One thing that I'm quite familiar with in your South Bend City Church, which is the church, the community that you pastor, which is how old now?
Roughly 8 years old.
8 years old. So not quite a teenager yet, but so one of the things I know you kind of say behind the back in the background a little bit is that your church is a great place to lose your faith. And I want, you know, with that in mind, holding that, I'm just for those listening who, where it doesn't seem to make sense that their faith actually complements their mental health, that those actually seem at odds because something maybe hasn't grown up or matured. I just wonder if you could speak to that because that I'm sure you've had, that's been a part of your journey as well. But yeah, can you speak to that a little bit about when the faith that they hold hasn't grown up enough to match the large amount of life that's actually attacking them?
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, it's our little joke. South Bend City Church, a great place to lose your faith. we mean that in two ways. You know, one, we mean just knowing that, like in the modern world, people are going to wake up not everybody, but some people are going to wake up one day and realize, this doesn't make sense to me anymore for one reason or another. And for some people, that's a trauma on its own. Like sometimes maybe even like capital T trauma, depending on how acute that is for them. And then to lose your community the same day that you lose that faith, like just exacerbates that trauma. And I think that's just really messed up. Mm. So part of it is just to say, hey, we're going to agree to be the kind of community where the day that you wake up and you don't believe any of this, you can walk in here and say that. And you won't belong less because of that. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, maybe more to your point, Seth, like, yeah, there are versions of faith that have to be shed, right, as we evolve and grow. And I think in too many places, that's any version of that is sort of like the threat, and the church is there to protect you against that threat. And that's just wild and ironic to me, because really what we're saying is, like, we're going to create an institution whose entire mission is to prevent you from growing up. And so, like, our faith has to grow with us. And like any kind of evolution or growth, that means like shedding things before new things emerge. Athan just lost his tooth, right, Seth? Your son. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, all of our metaphors for growing include shedding, right? Leaving behind so that we can take on the new. And it's like all over the world that, at least as I see it, that God has made, you know, shedding and growing and shedding and growing. And so we're trying to figure out, how can church be a place that isn't against that process and isn't even neutral on that process, but actually becomes like an advocate for that in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I love to continue on that. You're talking about leaving behind, and, you know, I feel like we just talked about this in the podcast. Lots of people name the kind of three-step process of order, disorder, reorder. And I hear you talking about that. And I'm curious about how you help people in your community attend to their mental health. And I know it might not be phrased or maybe this isn't exactly how you're naming the way you're doing it, but I wanted to get into your mantras, your church's mantras. Because that's one of the ways that I kind of see you bringing these things together, you know, spirituality and well-being. I wonder if you could name that and even maybe put some pieces together there for us.
So we have four community mantras. These are kind of like our values, but we prefer the idea of mantras because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, I just have been in too many places where a value is like a really generic word that you slap on the wall, and then you can't really figure out when it's ever held your feet to the fire. And a mantra might, like, to me, a mantra is like a portable prayer that you carry with you, and you speak back to yourself for the purpose of your own transformation. And so we have four mantras that are meant to shape, you know, how we talk about Jesus and how we practice as a church. And so they are sushi, not fish stew, which is often the hardest one to explain with the full teaching. It's about purposeful, beautiful simplicity. It's about saying no a lot for the better yes, and keeping your eye on the main thing. Fields Not Factories. And now I think these next three really are the ones that probably most easily connect to what you're talking about. Fields Not Factories just names the fact that, like, our lives as human beings, every part of us, you know, the spiritual, the emotional, that they probably you probably better can describe them with metaphors that come from the field than with metaphors that come from the factory. And that was a reaction for me to, like, a season when I was reading a bunch of, like, church discipleship books, books that help pastors think about how to help people grow. And they're so formulaic. And, like, the more you read them, you're like, this book is shaped by an industrial imagination that says you can put a human being on the assembly line, run them through 8 steps, and they're supposed to come out the other end. And it just doesn't work that way, right? I think some of the virtue of that there is it allows us to name seasons, which include, like, seasons where you lay fallow. You know, I think the sort of incessant need to be positive or productive, or for your life to be, because even growth, like, needs seasons of non-growth, right? But it's weird to figure out how to, like, name that. So Fields Not Factories, practices, not performances. That seems really important. We mean, first of all, that, like, with God and with this community, you have nothing to prove. And so having sort of, like, removed the performance pressure, we're just free to practice. And, you know, like, in performance, failure is fatal. But in practice, failure, like, often failure is the best thing, right? Like, whether you're practicing a musical instrument or a spiritual practice, you come to the limit of your capacity, and that's actually the liminal space where something really powerful can happen. But if you're afraid to fail, you'll never let yourself go there, you know? With practices, I mean, sometimes that shapes how we gather on a Sunday. We love to do, like, an open floor often, where we just open it up and people can share things. I love, like, our community one way or another has figured out that you really can share whatever you want during that. And I love that. And then the community kind of perpetuates its own commitment to that, you know, by modeling it. And maybe a newcomer hears somebody share something during an open floor that you never would have shared in a church space, about a struggle or a failure point or something that somebody else would be ashamed of, or a surrender point or a weakness. And all they receive from it is a nodding kind of me too, man. Yeah. You know? And, that sort of drives that home. But then the last one, which has kind of become the heartbeat of our community, is everyone an icon. And this is like Bible theology 101. Every human being is a bearer of the image of God. And in case you wonder what that means, that's Genesis 1 and Genesis 9, when Noah is coming out of the ark after the flood. For the first time ever, Scripture gives a prohibition against murder. And the reason you're not allowed to murder people in that text is that the people that you're murdering bear the image of God, which to me, like, just says, like, the way that we treat one another ought to be as if we are, you know, acting upon God. And so I think it's powerful for a person to see himself or herself as a bearer of the divine image. I mean, what a baseline of dignity, you know, and worthiness that a lot of religion hasn't given us. And then it's powerful to begin to see each other that way. And so I hope that that means that we can create a space where no matter how you walk in, you feel safe and seen. You're not a project. You're not a problem to solve, no matter how you walk in. Now, we might have to manage some safety issues sometimes, but even how we do that has to be predicated on that baseline. And so I hope that there's a lot of sort of good mental health, or like that the implications of those mantras point and are helping us create a space that's going to be more healing than harmful.
And a more healthy faith. Like,
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing those. And Seth, inviting him to share those with us. Yeah, because those things do come together, and all those mantras are beautiful.
Man, I think what speaks to that the most in my mind is just the mantra of, like, fields, not factories. And, like, God created each of us so incredibly uniquely. And I mean, you've never seen two apples that look exactly alike, right? Like, they all have very different dimensions, different qualities. And that's what God intended for humanity, right? That we're all unique. Like, no two pieces of any kind of produce are identical. But anything you get coming out of a factory will be 100% identical all the time. And when we're driven to become a carbon copy of something that we were never created to be, I just think it's very beautiful that you're creating the space for people to be fully human, fully unique, fully who they are. I think that's so refreshing, and the world needs more of it.
Thanks, Anna. I need more of it. How's that?
We all do.
I was going to ask you if you have, like, any specific practices that you guys, that you offer, that you recommend, or that you do together around that?
Yeah. it's a little loose on that. I mean, that open floor is pretty consistent for us. That's one. I know it's just sharing, but it kind of democratizes the room and creates a lot of empowerment, I think. Mariah, who leads worship for us, she's our director of art and worship. She often takes us through a breath prayer practice. In fact, she just did one this Sunday. It's not like we do it every week or every third week or whatever, but it's frequently woven in. And we'll stretch that sort of guided time, 10, 15, 20 minutes with maybe some music and some, you know, other sort of liturgical elements. But a lot of it is her coaching, just kind of like deep breath exercise. And I even just an hour ago, we did the one on Sunday, and there's another person at our church who, like, her full-time work as a practitioner is breath work with people for kind of therapeutic effect. And it, like, it meant a lot to me that this other person, like, messaged me and just was, as a practitioner, she was really affirming what was happening on Sunday and how Mariah led us.
Can I just follow up on that for people listening that aren't familiar with that? How does breath work or a breath prayer help someone incarnate their, you know, the divine in them?
Yeah, I mean, and you might be able to say more about this than I can, Seth, so please, like, fill it out for me. And Mariah might be able to say more than I can. To me, what seems pretty clear is it begins with presence. Like, it really does something to bring you here, right? And present with your body. And I think that that's really kind of rare sometimes, any part of our day. So you bring us to a point of really deep presence, like we're actually here. And then she'll add these really simple little mantras alongside, you know, breathe in. And I actually forget what they were for Sunday, but they were really great. With every breath in, there's a sort of a 3-4-word phrase, and that with every breath out, that I think, like, you can feel the room, like, collecting itself again, all the scatteredness. Seth, I've heard you say that presence is for your mind and your body to be in the same place. Do I have that right? Yeah, I think that's the effect of that. But maybe you could say more about why that's important, or, you know, along the concern for healing.
Yeah, I appreciate you. You did mention that you might turn this back on us a little bit too, so should have been ready for that. I mean, breathing is the most consistent, mundane thing that every human does all the time without thinking or realizing it. And so returning to what we have at the utmost, like, been conditioned to not even realize or take for granted, to return to that and actually inhabit the breath, the most mundane thing that actually keeps us alive, I think is one of the most important, best ways to incarnate just this simple experience of being here. And, you know, like the breath prayer throughout tradition, any tradition, is usually associated, like, with what you were saying. Some kind of words that you associate with the inhale and some kind of words that you associate with the exhale. And it's meant to, like, the longer you do that, it becomes just like the breath, where you don't realize now that you're praying it, because it's just like your breath. You don't realize that you're breathing, right? So you associate those words with the breathing, and then you're literally, as Paul said, praying without ceasing. And you can do that with words, but also I think a more expanded understanding is just simply understanding that breath is the, when you make it present, when you become present to it, that it is the way to live incarnated, because you already are. It's just becoming present to it.
There's a family at our church right now going through a really hard thing. Husband, pancreatic cancer. And there are a number of compounding layers in their family story that make this even harder and scarier. And I know for her, as she's walking with him through this, that honestly, like, the only thing I can think to say to her is, I want you to stay right here right now, because it's all you have. It's all you ever had. And this doesn't change that. You know what I mean? Like, even before you found out he had pancreatic, all you had was right here and right now. And I can, as she and I talk, there's history and there's pain back there that this moment draws forward. And then there's anxiety about the future that this brings backward. And as far as I can tell, like, maybe the best thing for her right now is just to keep coming back. Like, if you can just keep coming back, because all you have is right here, right now. And that's not any different than it was the day before you got the news. And I don't know how much that's helping her, but I hope she's able to carry that with her, because that seems really important. And to see her breathing on Sunday as Mariah was leading her, I was really hopeful for her, because I thought, if even for a moment here as a community we can impart this, I hope it'll travel well with her, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of times people make this misconception that surrender is a passive thing, especially spiritual kinds of surrender, when I think returning to the breath is an active surrender, that I'm letting go, but it's a deep trust that there's something holding me while I'm experiencing this. And in that being held, you know, we're in this together, whether that's community or your higher power. But yeah, I love that. I wanted to just continue to extend this a little bit, you know, along with the idea of in a lot of ways, how some aspects of the Christian traditions have maybe kind of disembodied us in a lot of ways. What are some other misconceptions about the relationship between mental health and faith that you see?
Let's see. Out of the gate, what comes to mind is that somehow that the faith that God is looking for, and you're already kind of saying this, George, that the faith that God rewards or blesses, right, is one that denies your reality rather than one that holds it. I think that's a big one. You can call it spiritual bypassing. You can call it whatever, but I think that's a really big deal. You mentioned the body. I mean, I think that's another big one where, and this is a real learning journey for me. I'm a head type. By disposition. And so coming home to my body feels like a really long journey. And I think there are probably ways that early in my life, the faith that I thought I was being taught just reinforced that disconnection. And that faith is all about, you know, thoughts and words rather than bodies. That seems like a really big deal. I'm not sure where this lands and what you're asking, Seth, but I think, let me try to connect this. I'll think out loud with you. Another part of SBCC's journey, so we began as a vastly majority white church and a pretty narrow socioeconomic band of people. And that original core group did not look very much like the totality of the city of South Bend, to be honest. And the truth is it still doesn't, but it's growing in that direction. I don't know that I heard a lot of explicit messages that were keeping me from people who were different from me, but I heard very little that was propelling me toward people who were different from me. And I think there's just something going on right now that I don't have a lot of words for in my own life. As I get the benefit of like learning from and sitting in solidarity with people who, because of sexuality, gender, race, economics, have lived very different stories from my own, it's like something's being healed in me and put back together in me. And I think churches and faith spaces ought to be places that call us toward one another. And then together we get to benefit from that impact. And again, I don't know that I heard, I think it was probably more implicit than explicit growing up, the things that kept me from that. But there's something going on there, and maybe I'll come back to you in 5 years and know how to talk about it. But that seems important too.
I have one other question, and it comes out of your book. And I just wonder if you could speak to this, but you talk about welcoming emptiness. Mm. I'm sure there's people that are listening right now that aren't in the best place right now, and they're just trying to find the path of healing and health and well-being, but you say this, you said, I'm also learning not to run from the inner experience of emptiness. This was in your book, When the World Breaks, but rather to sit with it, to even welcome it. And you say this, encountering God is not just in the fullness of life, but in the emptiness of life too. Can you speak to someone who's listening right now that feels that emptiness?
Yeah, I think, so Jesus' first beatitude is blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And there's a lot of different ways to read that. But these days I resist any reading that makes that a virtue. Like you've emptied yourself out proactively to make room for God. And I'm not even saying that's all wrong. That's just not the reading that makes sense to me right now. Rather, I think what I've learned over and over again is that like when really hard things hit, the hardest thing to name is the emptiness because it's just an absence. Like it's hard to name nothing. Cole Arthur Riley, some of your listeners might know her. She's got the Instagram account Black Liturgies. And if they don't know it, they should check it out. She writes really profound prayers and she's written a book now, maybe two books now. But Cole Arthur Riley, she was writing this piece for The Atlantic, this article about the pressure that she feels as a sort of social media influencer in this kind of faith and spirituality space and justice, and the pressure that she feels to have an immediate thing to say about every tragedy that hits the world. And then she's kind of inventorying, she's like, but where do I, in the face of that expectation, have the space to attend to what's within me when all this, forgive me, when the shit hits the fan, when this hard stuff happens? And so she's giving the litany of the anger, the rage. And then she said, the nothing at all. How do I attend to the nothing at all? And like the metaphors that come to mind for me these days is like when hard things happen, whether it's like you get the phone call from the doctor, or your partner proves to have not been faithful, or nothing happens around you, but just something breaks inside you. And it's almost like you have this place inside where you would hope to turn and find within you hope and joy and power and like that sort of sourcing that you hope to turn to within, from which you live. You know, it's the place that you want to draw on when you want to like take care of your family and you want to show up brave at work. And like you look there and it feels like there's nothing there. And it's like you've been robbed, and you feel like whether somebody like stole that from you or just something happened and like the vacuum pulled it out of you and there's nothing left. And I think, at least in my own life, I've learned over time that a lot of my patterns of behavior that are less than helpful, they really just come from like I'm being unable to sit with that emptiness. And it's hard to name it because emptiness is hard to name. And so like a word for that for me is to abide it, to simply like, to just like be able to sit with it. And it, in some ways, it's harder for me to sit with the emptiness than it is with the anger or the sadness or the other things. Because at least those are something, you know. I can do something with sadness. Yeah. I can cry, or I can write a book, or I can, you know, watch a sad movie. I can wallow in it. But the emptiness, that's a hard one. But I mean, if it's true that that's some of what Jesus means by that first beatitude, it's really profound to me that for people who don't know, the beatitudes are the blessings that Jesus gives in Matthew 5. And they're at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, which is three chapters of Jesus describing this really profound way of living, a way of living where you're not anxious and you don't worry about tomorrow, and a way of living where you don't exploit other people, and a way of living where you forgive your enemies, and a way of living where you have integrity, like this really big picture of a great way of being. But like the threshold that you cross to get into that way of being is these strange blessings. And it's almost like he's saying like, that truly good way of life isn't going to actually flow through you. I mean, you can try to perform it, but it isn't going to actually come through you unless you cross through this threshold where I'm trying to woo you into like an abiding with your emptiness, like to stop running from it and learn what it can show you. And then as you sort of stop trying to bypass that, but sit with it and trust the blessing, then over time, maybe this way of life will flow out of you organically, like a true form of life that flows through you that you're not going to get to if you just keep trying to perform it on its own, you know?
In that emptiness, what does it mean for you to encounter God?
Yeah, to begin with, it means, man, I just like growing up, I'd go like summer camps and sit in church services. And then I went to this Christian college that had a more kind of charismatic bent to it. And like, nothing wrong with that. But it's like more and more and more I had convinced myself that if God is with me, I will feel so full. Man, I don't know. That makes me kind of tender. And it's just like so liberating to say like, yeah, maybe the emptiness inside does not indicate that you're 1 millimeter further away from God than you felt when you woke up and, you know, you felt a river flowing through you. It's like if, maybe that's part of the thing, right? Is like, you know, whether it's Christ on the cross or this whole stream of Christian tradition that's called apophatic, which basically names God in absence. Like maybe the miracle is to realize like that that's a red herring, whether you feel full or empty. And the you know, so it's kind of funny. It's like part of it is like, I don't even know how to describe what it feels like to meet God in the emptiness. And yet I would take everything I've got and stake it on the experience I've had that God is there. But to even try to find words for it is to almost defy it, because then I start grasping again for images of fullness, and I'm all for the fullness, and it comes. But man, what a liberation to discover that the tradition is also teaching us that what feels totally vacated and empty and abandoned is no less the location of God.
Jason, please don't stop helping us point our hearts toward that kind of hope. And where can we find you? Obviously, you're on Instagram. Where can we get this book, and how can people who maybe are wrestling with what you just talked about, you know, how can they experience, like you do a YouTube invitation with some questions and guiding people through these chapters, but how can people find that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So if they just go to jasonadammiller.com and they can find like book resources tied to it there. So like links for the study guide and all that stuff are there. Instagram is the only social media that I mess around with these days. So I'm Jason Adam Miller on Instagram. And then the kind of most frequent place to find what I'm trying to create would actually be the Salpin City Church podcast. And so many weeks, not every week, I'm preaching there. And on the weeks I'm not preaching, there's probably something better going on. So you should listen then. But just look for South Bend City Church on any podcast platform, and you can tune into what's going on, both teachings and, like, for example, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure this Thursday, Mariah's going to post that guided breath liturgy that we did on Sunday. And so if people want to get to benefit from some of those guided moments that come from some of my teammates, they will often, they're not always find those on the podcast too.
Well, Jay, I just want to say thank you for making time. Thank you for coming on. And, you know, you've heard all this heart stuff from me before, but I really think, you know, you, one of the reasons that we wanted to bring you on to the Restore podcast is because you, you know, you really do embody wisdom, which I think as an Enneagram type 5 is less knowing more and knowing with more of you. And you've really figured out how to do that. And I think that actually is your book is a deep well of knowing with more of you and the ways that you've taken knowledge and applied it compassionately. And I just, for anybody listening who's interested in having a kind of a rework of the Beatitudes, trying to maybe understand how they're actually more applicable and beneficial for those that might be in suffering, I would highly, highly recommend this book. Even though I might be biased, I still think it's one of the best things out there on this kind of content. So, Jay, just before you you split, though, I just wondered if there's anything on your heart that you wanted to leave our listeners with.
I think I would, man, just last night, I was texting somebody who's facing a really hard moment where their humanity and, like, all of who they are and their truth is at a crossroads as to whether they will own it or not. And the fear is raging. And right in front of them right now, they see all that it could cost them. And I feel for your listeners the way I feel for this person. I just want to say, like, keep going. Like, keep going. And and as you do, you will find that there's a whole chorus of people out here who are on the same path. And you may not know them yet, but you'll find you're not alone. And, you know, we tend to find each other on this walk. And over time, you will collect endless stories that give witness to the fact that that journey is, like, it's the only journey and it's worth it. And so, yeah, anybody who's tuning into Restore, I think that's really amazing, because I think Restore is one of the bright lights for people who are trying to walk that path. And anybody who's showing up in a room with other people to do that, whether it's a church service or a Restore group, like, what a profound way to take seriously the measure of your life. And so, yeah, I'm, like, really grateful that you all are doing what you're doing. We need more of what Restore is up to in the world. And I'm super grateful I got to hang out with you guys today.
Thank you so much, Jason. And thank you, friends, for listening in. You got to hear from Jason Adam Miller. And please look him up. Get his book. And if you are looking for someone to journey with, please check us out online at restoresmallgroups.org. We'd love to just introduce you to some groups, some different safe spaces to find others to journey with. But thank you for joining us here and listening, and we'll see you back again here soon. Hey, it's George. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Searching Inward podcast. If you've enjoyed listening or have benefited in any way from the podcast, we would love for you to come alongside and join us in the mission to bring hope and healing to the world. By considering becoming a monthly giver of even $5, you're making a huge impact in the ways we're able to serve. Please consider giving by going to restoresmallgroups.org/donate. Thanks.